Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. I guess I believe is slightly delayed. We're talking about Haiti again today. I have to talk about Haiti from time to time because it is such an important topic for me. I don't think I mentioned before, when I began writing 4 years ago, aside from the first thing I ever wrote, which was an accidental, very brief book review that I never intended to write, but I ended up doing it. The first real article I ever wrote was about Haiti, and the reason I did it was I was just obsessed about a people that was so oppressed for so long, and nobody talks about it, and I just had to say something, so I did. I wrote a very long article. Oh, I've written a number since, a few recently. They had a sham election on April 19th, and we can talk about that during the program and other things going on in the country. But my guest today is Brian Concannon, and Brian has been on before. I'm delighted to have him back, hopefully. Brian is a distinguished human rights lawyer. He's the director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, and it works the way they describe their work. They work with grassroots groups in Haiti, also in the U.S. and the Haitian diaspora, and they do it to develop an effective human rights advocacy program with global outreach. There's always something going on in Haiti. Try finding a news report in the major media. I don't think any people anywhere in the world have suffered more longer than the people of Haiti. How about 500 years, over 500 years? With a couple of brief periods when they won their freedom, and it didn't last. Most recently in the 1990s when Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected, then overthrown in a U.S.-staged coup, then allowed to come back under Bill Clinton with very strict reins on him that he struggled valiantly to free himself from, did all he could, more than any other president ever did for Haiti. That's why Haitians love him so much. He's now in exile because there was another coup on the 29th of February, 2004. The U.S. Marines in action, your military in action, overthrowing democratically elected leaders, beloved by the people. His second election, he won by about 90% of the vote. I would say that's pretty conclusive. And it wasn't a fixed election, the theatrical kind we have here. It was the real McCoy, although the opposition tried their best to fix it, so the result might come out otherwise. Well, Aristide won. Aristide would have won by simply putting his name on the ballot. The people want him back. He's now in exile in South Africa. Hopefully one day he will be back. But we want to talk about Haiti, what's going on there. Again, so much. Brian, are we connected by any chance? Oh, not yet. He must be involved with something because I know Brian and I communicated very well, and he knows he's on today. I hope an emergency didn't come up. You never know. He told me when I we exchanged emails last that he'd just come back from an awfully hectic travel schedule. So he's all over the place doing all kinds of things. And I don't know if anything last minute came up this morning. If that happened, then I'll surely get him back if anything goes awry today. But we've got our first break coming up. Let's go ahead and take that, and we'll come back. I'll tell you a little bit about what's going on and carry on as best I can.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Indeed, I think we've made contact with Brian. Brian, are you on now?
I am. Sorry for not being available, Steve.
Oh, there's no problem. I used the first few minutes to introduce you properly and make a few comments about Haiti and, the brief periods and over a 500-plus year period when Haitians enjoyed some freedom, especially under Jean-Bertrand Aristide and the horrible stuff that's gone on in that country for centuries, absolute centuries. And I think of Haiti, Brian, as a country that has been more long-suffering under such terrible conditions that really don't have to be than maybe any other people in the world. I think 500 years is a pretty daunting period of time, with only a couple of brief periods when things really eased up, and they didn't last. And Haitians are going through so much today. Oh, we most recently the sham elections on April 19th last summer, the terrible hurricanes that just devastated the country, and I guess the struggle goes on to come up from under that. Has there been any relief on that?
From coming up from the hurricanes, there has been. The international community did come through with some money and some other help, and so there has been work in terms of digging out from the mud and fixing roads. But surprisingly, not even all the mud is dug out. One of my colleagues went to Gonaive last month, and he said people are still literally digging out their houses, and that there's still a lot on the streets that have not been fixed. And that's a concern because hurricane season starts in about 2 weeks on June 1st. And although there often are not a lot of hurricanes in June, they are going to come eventually. And the fact that the country isn't quite yet prepared for it is troubling. And it's important to remember that Haiti is actually fairly well protected from hurricanes because hurricanes come from east to west, and Haiti's on the western side of the island of Hispaniola with a pretty high mountain range, one of the mountains even over 10,000 feet, that hurricanes usually need to cross. And as a result, hurricanes hit Haiti with less frequency than a lot of other islands in the Caribbean or other countries, and generally with less severity. And it's not the arrival of the hurricanes, it's Haiti's vulnerability that causes the problems. For instance, there's been several hurricanes that have hit other countries much worse, but Haiti ends up bearing a much higher cost in human lives and general destruction because of man-made causes, because the mountains are deforested, because the basic infrastructure isn't there to divert the water away from residential areas, because people are forced to live in flood-prone areas, and those are all human caused. And as you mentioned, one of those causes is the fact that Haiti has gotten the short end of the stick from the international community for hundreds of years, and that has prevented the Haitian government from developing into a government that can build adequate roads and can enforce deforestation laws.
And Haiti has the misfortune of being much too close to the U.S., Brian, although the world is so small now that if the U.S. wants to reach out and control any country anywhere, it can pretty much do it. We circle the globe with hundreds and hundreds of military bases, and all of the technology we have. My goodness, we can jump on any country and do anything we want to them. Certainly, a country as small as Haiti, that it would be like squashing an ant to do anything that we wanted to Haiti. But it's shameful. I think of Haiti in the same terms, Brian, as Iraq. I think of both countries as being occupied, but people in our country know that Iraq is occupied. They have no idea what's going on in Haiti. Instead of the Marines being down there, we have so-called UN peacekeepers. And you remember I wrote an article way back, I called them paramilitary peacekeepers, because they're a pretty brutal bunch, and they generally get contingents from countries where the military isn't too kind to people when they have to take them on. So I don't know what countries are represented now, but I guess fairly recently, or not too long ago, Jordan, Brazil, countries like that.
The peacekeeping force is led by Brazil, with the largest components from other South American countries, many of which have had their own problematic histories of military coups and military abuses of power. But also Jordan is another contributor. The People's Republic of China is another. And then there's a couple African countries that have smaller contingents.
But again, the country is occupied. A democratically elected leader was overthrown for the second time. And nobody even bats an eye. You don't get any news reports. Nobody has any idea what's going on in Haiti. And here you have a country that is one of the most deeply impoverished in the world, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, the people, the going wage for Haitians who have work, and I forget the percentage that don't, but an extremely high percentage of Haitians have no jobs, certainly no regular jobs, and when they get one, it pays something like 11 cents an hour. Well, who can live on 11 cents an hour anywhere? And then we had last year the terrible rise in food prices. So people in Haiti are literally starving to death. I wrote about eating mud cookies. It may fill your stomach, but it certainly doesn't do anything for you nutritionally. So Haitians are really going through a very, very tough time, and it never gets easy for them under the best conditions.
And one of the things, you know, working in Haiti for as long as I have, it's amazing the resiliency of the Haitian people, that they can put up with an amazing amount of deprivation and still keep working together towards a better future. But what they do need, and it's amazing, they don't seem to need a lot of food, don't seem to need decent housing, and still manage to keep fighting. But what they do need is hope. They do need the hope that this work will create a better life, not necessarily for them, but for their children. I mean, I hear that all the time from people who are in desperate poverty, and they say, look, I can take this, but what I can't take is that the knowledge that my children will grow up in these same conditions. And going back to the elections of April 19th, I think what that did was it robbed Haitians of hope. When elections are well run in Haiti, and there's been several, not perfectly run in the sense of logistically everything's there, but in the sense that they're basically democratic, that the people who that the candidates are allowed to run, and that the results are more or less the people's choice. When that happens, Haiti just becomes a festival. Voting day, everybody shows up. They wait in line for hours. They're chatting happily. They go home, and for the next couple weeks, everybody seems to be walking on air. And what happened on April 19th was the exact opposite, where most people stayed in. The official turnout result is 11%, which is extremely low, but it's probably a lot higher than the real results were. I don't know of anybody who did a full national survey, but the people who are doing local surveys came up with between 2% and 5% voting, and so it's unlikely that the places where people didn't get to, the observers didn't get to, had such a high turnout that really was 11. But even 11 is extremely low in a country like Haiti, where people will walk miles and wait in the hot sun for hours for democracy if they think that's hope. And let me talk a little bit about why that election stole the hope from people. And back in February, and we talked a little bit about this the last time we talked, back in February, the Electoral Council rejected all of the Famille-Lavalas candidates. And Famille-Lavalas is the party that has won every election in Haiti that it has contested, going back to 1990. And the Electoral Council at first accepted the party itself, and then it found a pretext, because there were two wings of the party that registered, it found a pretext to exclude every Lavalas candidate. And by almost any account, the Lavalas candidates would have won most of the seats, if not all the seats that were up. And at the time, there were 12 Senate seats that were up for election. When Lavalas was excluded, the international community actually did the right thing by Haiti, which gave a lot of us hope. The United States, the Organization of American States, the UN, the Canadian Embassy, they all came out with statements right away saying that this exclusion of the Lavalas party hurt the credibility, hurt the legitimacy of the elections, and that it need to be corrected. That was in February. By the time that April came around, those critiques had silenced. The problems with the elections had not been corrected, just that the international community decided that they were happy with an election without Lavalas. And so when the election Secretary of State Clinton actually went down to Haiti a couple days before the elections and did not mention anything about the problems with the exclusion of Famille-Lavalas. The OAS and the UN actually put out press releases bragging about their help for the elections and how much money they gave for them, and mentioned with some sadness the lack of turnout, but did not mention why there was a lack of turnout or the exclusion of the party that would have won those elections.
And these were delayed elections for 12 Senate seats. I saw, and I quoted in a little account that I wrote about, Brian, that by some estimates, you mentioned that the turnout was as low as 3%. A boycott was called because the elections were a sham. And finally, Lavalas is the party of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And again, the overwhelming majority of Haitians support this party. So you take the majority party out and you have other parties running that people don't support. The natural thing would be to not show up, stay home. And that's exactly what happened. And probably they'll let these elections go, you know, out of sight, out of mind. You have a brief reports about them for a day or so, very inadequate, very sketchy, don't explain much of anything. And AP reports or Voice of America reports, try finding out any real information from those sources. But,
I'll correct you. One thing that did happen was the AP actually wrote a very good article the day after the election. And that's interesting because in the past, the AP has been very much following the U.S. Embassy line. This time, the AP writer in Haiti wrote a good article, but that just didn't get picked up by anybody.
That's exactly what happens. Brian, we have to take another break. Let's do that, and we'll come right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour, talking about Haiti with Brian Concannon. Brian, we talked before, last time you were on, about René Préval and how disappointing he's been to the people of Haiti, and so many, I believe, now refer to him as a traitor. There was hope that he was his election would really make up a little bit for Aristide being overthrown by the coup. He was Préval was president in the 1990s. And I think he did. He carried on what Aristide had begun. I'm not sure if he did it as well, but enough to get the people behind him and serve the people of Haiti. And then he was reelected in an election that tried very hard to rig it to see that he wouldn't be. But I guess he's been pretty much co-opted in office, and he's following the line of the folks in Washington that pulled the strings. Very disappointing.
Yeah, people in Haiti are very disappointed. One thing that we do need to be clear about, and I think this is especially important coming as American citizens, is that a lot of the constraints on Préval are in fact imposed from abroad. And Haitian leaders have always been limited in what they can do in terms of implementing their electoral mandate, because it won't be accepted by the foreign community. And the best example is Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who went beyond where the international community wanted him to go. Not that he was doing anything illegal, but he was doing things like implementing a progressive economic policy. And that caused him to get kidnapped and sent to the Central African Republic. And even President Préval, it's important to remember that although the development assistance embargo was hardened against President Aristide when he took office in 2001, it was actually started against President Préval. And the reason for that was that President Préval at the time was not acting quick enough to privatize certain state entities. And it's very ironic that Haiti was punished for not adopting the same kinds of economic policies that drove the U.S. economy off the cliff. And in fact, if Haiti had been allowed to implement the policies that its voters voted for, the country would have been in a lot better shape now with the financial crisis. And so it's important to remember that I think Haitians need to criticize their elected leaders, but as non-Haitians, I think we need to look in the mirror, and we can't just criticize a Haitian leader. We need to say, what kind of constraints is our country putting on him?
Oh, I understand that very well, Brian. I mean, we see this playing out all over the world. My goodness, the long arm of the Pentagon can go anywhere at any time and do anything. And small countries, Aristide, when he was in office, abolished the Haitian military. What's a country like Haiti need a military for? Well, he abolished it. Now they reinstituted some. Well, of course they have the peacekeepers and they have an oppressive Haitian police, and but they don't work. They have no outside enemies. They work to repress the people. And I know Preval is under great duress to do what those outside powers want of him. Of course, Aristide was as well, and I guess he just had a constant tug of war doing all that he could, and at the same time, I guess, trying to be diplomatic. But it's a losing battle when you do virtually anything to help your people. That's not what Washington wants. They want the development to go to the corporate interests, both inside and outside the country, and that just deepens the trouble for the Haitian people. Somehow this has got to come to an end in Haiti, Brian, and everywhere else, right here in the U.S., that we're going through such terrible stuff right now. And I have a great fear, very honestly, despite all the hype about things bottoming out and getting better. I think it's a bunch of malarkey. My deep fear is the worst by far is yet to come. Well, we'll see. Predicting the future is very hazardous, but I'm very, very worried about that, including for all the people it will affect. So if it hits us hard here, think of the devastation to the people of Haiti that absolutely have nothing.
Yeah, it's important to remember, and that one of the things that Haitians say, and people all over the, and poor countries all over the world say this, is that when the United States catches a cold, Haiti catches the flu. And Haiti doesn't have a huge amount of trade with the United States, but what it does have is Haitians living in the United States who are sending back remittances. And the remittances that Haitians send back is most recently been calculated at about $2 billion a year, which is a lot of money. It dwarfs by far foreign aid. It dwarfs the government budget. And it's really what's keeping Haiti afloat. And those remittances have gone down sharply because Haitians in the U.S. work in a lot of businesses, industries like construction, like tourism, that are really taking a hit with the economic downturn here. And so we haven't seen, you know, in terms of as you were saying, we haven't seen the worst yet. It's clear that we haven't seen the worst yet from that in Haiti. The remittances have been cut drastically, but there's going to be a little bit of a lag effect to where between the remittances being stopped and people actually starving. But I think that we are heading towards that effect fairly inexorably.
And then you've got the added problem that we had a program about some weeks back on the Haitian immigrants to the U.S. We have to take another break and we can pick up on this. But 30,000 Haitians in the U.S., not legal citizens, targeted for deportation. So whatever income they're earning, if they're all sent back, that will all be lost to Haitians too. We need to take another break. Let's do that, Brian, and then talk more about this. I wanted to ask you where that stands right now.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour, talking about Haiti with Brian Concannon. Brian, last March you hooked me up with Steve Forrester on the subject of trying to win temporary protected status for 30,000 Haitians, I guess most of them in South Florida. Is he having any luck?
There's been some progress. The immigration lawyers will say that their clients are not currently being deported. And this applies to non-criminal deportees. There's a lot of deportation of people who have been convicted of a crime in the United States and they're sent back. That has not slowed down at all. But it appears there's been a de facto halt to deportations to Haiti, which is positive. The Obama administration has not yet agreed to grant TPS, which is temporary protected status, which, you know, Steve explained at length. It's basically a special status that allows people from a country that is suffering from natural disasters or civil strife to stay in the United States temporarily and to work and send money back to people in the home country. It's not only a justified measure in terms of the civil strife and natural disaster that Haiti has suffered. It's also a matter of equality, because there's been grants to other countries, including Nicaragua, Honduras, that had much less either civil strife or natural disasters, but that because they've got more political support, they were granted TPS, even though Haitians, who are much more deserving, did not get them. And it's not just a question of political support. I think when you look at any Haiti policy, any U.S. policy towards Haiti, it's hard to explain anything without the discussions of race. And when you make the comparison between Haiti and Central Americans getting TPS and Haitians and Cubans getting political asylum, it's pretty clear that one of the variables in there is race, and the fact that Haitians are black makes them less eligible for the generosity of the United States immigration law.
Oh boy, is it ever!
But see, can I just follow up one quick thing? What's happening in terms of advocacy? There's several organizations, and this is actually one of the neat things that's happened over the last few months, is that organizations that haven't previously worked on Haiti are coming together over this equality issue, and there is a developing network of people fighting for TPS. And the most recent action, yesterday there was a day of action in Washington, D.C., where immigration advocates from all over the country came up to meet with the Department of Homeland Security and with members of Congress. In conjunction of that, the American Friends Service Committee issued an action alert asking everybody to call up and call the White House comment line and let them know that you stand for TPS for Haitians. If anybody wants that, we've got that action alert up on our website, and our website is HaitiJustice.org. And although yesterday was the day to do it, a phone call today would be just as good, maybe even better, to reinforce everything that happened yesterday.
Oh, I urge listeners to do it. We get an awful lot of listeners, Brian, downloading the program, so many don't listen today. They'll listen tomorrow, the next day, whenever they do it. The little listening that I have a chance to do, this is the way I do it. I'll go to an archive, because I'm so involved in other stuff that I just can't listen when something comes on live. I would just say, whenever you hear this program, go to the website and make that phone call. You would think, Brian, that for the first time we have a black president, that he would at least feel a little bit more concern for people of his own race than all previous white presidents. I mean, my goodness, we had white presidents who cared more for black people than black people do.
I think that one of the problems that President Obama is at least perceives that he is facing is that he is perceived that there is widespread racism in the United States, and this has appeared to be the case ever since he was a senator, that he doesn't want to do things that will take him as a black president, or just as he didn't do things that would take him as a black senator. And I think that one of the ways that we can fight that is for us to pressure the White House on these issues. And if there are phone calls from a broad constituency telling President Obama, black, white, people who live in the United States who've had their family for generations, recent immigrants, all across the spectrum, if we call into the White House, that gives the president cover and pressure to do the right thing by Haiti. And in fact, that is really the crux of the matter. We've had lots of activists have and immigration leaders have called the White House and had conversations with the Department of Homeland Security, and people within the administration seem fairly convinced of the justification for TPS. What they're concerned about really is the political backlash, and it's basically Rush Limbaugh getting on the radio and fanning racist flames and talking about the president coddling Haitians. And we need to respond to that. I mean, the reality is that Rush Limbaugh's listeners get on the phones and they call their representatives, they call the White House. And I think one of the things we can do to counteract that is that we need for people like your listeners who are much better informed, to be as activist as the Rush Limbaugh's listeners.
Oh, absolutely. Brian, if I'm lucky, I might get 100,000 listeners and Rush Limbaugh with his absolute hate talk. I don't know what he gets, 2 million, 3 million. And people eat that stuff. It's amazing. Lincoln was right, Brian. You know, you can't fool all of the people all of the time, but you sure can fool enough of them enough of the time to cause one heck of a lot of mischief and trouble. It's a shame.
But 100 calls on this issue, if 100 out of 100,000 listeners call the White House on this issue, that's close to that's a wave, and that would make a huge difference. So I encourage everybody. You know, unfortunately, we don't have the media monopoly that Rush Limbaugh has. But if your listeners get on the phone, and it's a very quick phone call, doesn't take you more than 2 or 3 minutes, just be on record as supporting temporary protected status for Haitians. That will make the difference.
Oh, absolutely, Brian. It's amazing. I mean, we do this. We give TPS for Central Americans, more Salvadorans, I think, than any other group back in around 1990. Over 250,000 Salvadorans got TPS. And I think it's for 1 year, but it's renewable. They just keep renewing it year after year if conditions warrant. But look at the difference between what we haven't done for Haitians and what we do for Cubans. And I wrote about this some weeks, months back. Oh, I've got it up on my desktop. It was in 1966. We passed a Cuban Adjustment Act, and it was referred to as a wet foot, dry foot policy. Any Cuban, non-U.S. citizen, can come to the U.S., and if he or she makes it touches down on land in the U.S., then they can automatically be eligible to stay. But Haitians get interdicted, and even the ones who make it, are targeted for removal to be put in incarceration, terrible conditions, supposedly temporary conditions. They're just awful. They're just terribly mistreated. And we do everything possible, at least we have up until this point, to send them back. And these people come because they're in such desperation that, I mean, it's almost a matter of getting here to survive and risking their lives to come in these rickety crafts, whatever they use to travel from Haiti, over waters, and a lot of them drown en route just to do anything to try to get here and find relief. Some make it, many don't, and they reach and they find a hostile country, a hostile government facing them. No matter what they do, even if they do make it, it's a terrible situation. Yeah, I know politics is politics, Brian. I could never be a politician because I absolutely could never do anything like that. I know exactly what I would do on my first day in office, Brian, if I were president, but that's another program.
That's something to dream about. But let me follow that. That was an excellent explanation about the stresses that Haitians are under. And there is actually a solution to that. And the solution to that is democracy. Between 1994 and 2000, when Haitian democracy was allowed to work, and you had 2002, and you had two consecutive transfers of presidential power, you had developing legislative elections, you had basic stability, the refugee numbers dropped. And it's actually a fairly simple solution. If we let Haitian democracy develop, we're going to have less problems with refugees coming to our shores. And as long as we don't let that happen and we support undemocratic regimes or undemocratic activities by elected officials and we undermine elected popular governments, we're always going to have a problem with the refugees. And Steve, I can kind of clarify a point I made before about criticizing President Prevala. I think, as I said, I think it's important that as Americans we criticize what our government does that constrains President Prevala. But I agree with you that we also do need to echo the criticism that Haitians make. And as you explained, Haitians are extremely concerned that President Prevala is having policies that are far to the right of where he was elected. And I also think it's perfectly legitimate for foreigners in Haiti to criticize when the president does not follow the rules of the game, of the democratic game, because that implicates international human rights law. Haitian voters and citizens have an internationally protected human right to participate in a fair process, and that obviously isn't happening. And I think that the elections are one thing. I mean, I think there's lots of things that we can blame the United States for. I'm not sure that that is it. I haven't seen evidence. Certainly the United States in the end supported President Prevost in his decision to eliminate the Lavalas party from the elections. But it looks to me, and certainly Haitians on the ground feel this way, that it was a President Prevost's initiative to keep the Lavalas party out as a way of building his own party. And not coincidentally, a candidate from his party either won outright or is in the runoff for every single one of those seats, when it's likely that if it had been a fair election, the Lavalas candidate would have won almost all of those seats.
And that's only one issue of so many political prisoners. Is another issue. Preval hasn't really done much of anything to help people rotting away in Haitian prisons. I think many cases uncharged, some of them ill, maybe close to death. And
yeah, one example that fits all those criteria is Ronald Dauphin, who's now been in jail since March 1st of 2004, so over 5 years. Hasn't had a trial. An appeals court threw out the charging document against him 2 years ago and ordered the courts to redo it. They kept him in jail, and the government refuses to serve the appeals court order. It's a very short, easy technical step, but it won't do that. And what that does is it keeps Ronald Dauphin in legal limbo, where his lawyers can't even ask for pretrial release for him, because the trial judges say, well, we haven't been served with this order. And so it's keeping him in this horrible legal limbo. A human rights delegation visited him 3 weeks ago, and during the visit, he actually passed out. There was a nurse on the delegation who said, it looks like his body is shutting down. And Ronald's lawyer, ever since then, Ronald's lawyer has been trying to get a doctor in to examine him, and the prison officials have been stonewalling. And that's again something that I don't think we can blame the United States for. I think that's President Prevost on President Prevost's shoulder.
Oh, it gets me so upset, Brian. I don't know the names the way you do, but I know this goes on against, I guess, a fair number of people, maybe more people than I even realize, but people who are guilty of absolutely nothing except that they support movements like Fanmi Lavalas, and they want real democracy, and they want to help the people of Haiti, and then this becomes a crime. And I guess the operative term in the U.S. Is to call these people terrorists. I mean, anybody who fights for human rights and justice and equity for ordinary people, that brands you as a terrorist. Well,
that's one of the good things about being on your show, Steve, because you've got such a broad reach and you connect the dots, which I think is very important. I mean, it's easy for people like me who's preoccupied by Haiti to think, okay, this is a Haiti problem, this is a Haiti problem. But when I listen to shows like yours and you start seeing the same bad, very bad things happening over and over again in different countries, it shows how this is all connected. And I think it's very important for all of us to make those connections.
Oh, it is such a major issue for me, Brian. We discuss it all the time. As much as any other topic in this program is occupied Palestine, it absolutely obsesses me, like Haiti, and it's a similar situation. The absolute terrible suffering by people and the world community just allied against the civilian population that gets stomped on time and again. And the only difference between one of the differences between Palestine and Haiti is the Haitians don't get attacked. They may get attacked on the ground by powerful automatic weapons, but the poor Palestinians get attacked by illegal weapons, white phosphorus that burns the skin to the bone, and water won't put it out. F-16s attack helicopters. And, of course, we had a three-week horrendous assault that murdered 1,400 people, injured another 5,000, 6,000. Gaza was under such duress for so long under siege. Under siege, all borders blocked, almost nothing let in, and then it gets attacked by the world's fourth most powerful military. I mean, you can imagine, I just have to keep talking about stuff like this. And you saw, I just wrote a raft of articles on this. I couldn't stop. And we'll have more programs on this, on what's going on. And the conflict ended the 18th of January, formally, Brian, but it never ended. It goes on every day. There are more attacks day after day after day, and nobody cares. Nobody lifts a finger. Well, the Haitians suffer in their way. They're terribly oppressed day after day after day, and nothing gets said about it. Nothing gets done about it. It's like the tree that falls in the forest, but nobody hears or sees it, so it didn't happen.
And one of the things, I mean, even beyond the obvious moral outrage that Haiti and Palestine should be precipitating in all of us is the fiscal outrage. I mean, it's an incredible waste of money as a taxpayer of the international community. It drives me up a wall that and it's same thing in Palestine, same thing in Haiti, that we invest money to so-called development, and then all that money gets basically flushed down the toilet because of political developments that we either allow or instigate, and then we're going back and spending millions and tens of millions of dollars to repair the things that we allowed to get broken. And it's just, you know, it's amazing that we're not seeing that these policies just don't work. Keeping Haiti down, keeping Palestine down, isn't doing the United States any good, whether you look at middle term or long term. And perhaps short term it might help our friendships with friends whose friendships we should probably be examining. But in the long run, in the midterm, it doesn't do us any good.
Oh, it sure doesn't. We have to break again, Brian, in one last segment. The hour goes by so fast.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. Come on with Brian Kincannon and Haiti. Brian, it also obsesses me so much that think of our tax dollars at work. We spend such an inordinate amount on militarism, foreign wars, occupations, supporting foreign dictators, plus so much handed out to major corporations. The headline stuff is all the trillions we're giving to bankers that got us into this trouble in the first place. But people also should think about year after year after year, going back many decades, hundreds of millions. It comes to a lot of billion dollars that we hand over in all kinds of subsidies. I know I wrote an article sometime back. I just started itemizing stuff that goes, whether it's agricultural supports or to the defense contractors and so on. And almost nothing comes back to help people in this country. So, you know, if we don't do anything for the people here, what are we going to do for Haitians?
That's true. And there's also a lot of parallels there. And as we're talking a while back about the trying to impose an economic policy that has failed Haitians. And in some ways, Haiti isn't, we often think of Haiti as this anachronism that it's something from out of the world's past that we're trying to get rid of. But in other ways, Haiti's actually the future. When you look at the great division and, of the maldistribution of wealth, the privatization of state services, you know, where 20 years ago, we had clean water out of our faucets, and now we're, like Haitians, we're having to get water elsewhere. And in many ways, Haitians call themselves the laboratory, and they say that Haiti's experimented on, and if those experiments work, then they export them. And I think that's happening to the United States. I think the fact that we're spending money on wars, on tax breaks for mutual fund, or sorry, not mutual fund, hedge fund, managers, rather than trying to give all our citizens a minimum necessary food, education, and health care, that's a parallel development to what's going on in Haiti. And I think that's another reason why all U.S. citizens should worry about Haiti, because we may be next.
Oh, absolutely. My metaphor, Brian, is Guatemala. And I honest to goodness see a very subversive plot to turn this country, not just this country, but I think countries everywhere into Guatemala or Haiti, which basically is stripping away basic rights, stripping away labor rights, confined people to low wage jobs. Just a terrible situation that there could be an awful future if we allow this to happen. It is so worrisome. And take a look at Haiti. You can read lots about Haiti. The few articles that I've written, I think anybody could Google Haiti and find some very good material on it. And Brian, your website, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, give your website very briefly.
Sure. It's www.haitijustice.org. And we have, among other things, we have all of Steve Lenman's articles on Haiti. And it's a good place to get information, because one of the things, advantages that we have that we didn't have 10 years ago is it's still true that you're not going to get good information about Haiti delivered in a piece of plastic on your doorstep or on the nightly news. But you can get good information. Shows like this, there's lots of people writing good pieces for the internet, and so with a little bit of effort, it's not a lot of effort, just checking websites like ours, www.haitijustice.org, you can stay up to date on what's going on in Haiti.
Oh, and again, you said the key thing, take a look at Haiti, because that may be what we're heading for. Brian, we're out of time. They're going to cut away. I just have time to thank you so much for coming on again. We will do this again, right?
Anytime you want me, I'll be happy to be on, Steve.
Oh, Brian, it is always a great joy for me to have you on the program. You're one of my heroes, and we will come back and pick up the Haiti story again without any question.
Okay, yeah, thanks. And that's exactly what Haiti needs.
We'll keep hammering on it, and we'll be back tomorrow with another program. Join us.